Chatting with the greatest minds in the Bitcoin space. This is a Bitcoin Audible chat. What's up, guys? We got a really awesome chat today. I did this just a couple of hours ago with Kevan Devani from the Total Connector and the Total Bitcoin podcast. I'm sure a lot of you guys know that show out there. He's been around for a while and has a lot of great interviews with so many people in this space. It's definitely one to check out if you haven't. But let's go ahead and actually just jump right into our conversation. We just kind of had a joint thing. I'm not sure if I was on his show or he was on my show. We just, it had been overdue and it was time for us to sit down and have a chat. And I'm glad we did because it was a ton of fun. So I hope you're stacking sats with swanbitcoin.com/guy. In fact, I got my comforting lets me sleep well at night email last night that I had stacked with Swan another $50 every week, and it just feels so good. And I want to share that. So go to swanbitcoin.com/guy and start your Bitcoin savings plan. Set it and forget it. Let's go ahead and jump in to our chat with Kevan Devani from the Total Bitcoin podcast.
Well, hello. My special guest, or actually, I'm a special guest of Guy Swan, and he's a special guest of mine. So we're doing sort of a mutual show here. I'm the co-host of not the co-host. Goddamn, what am I saying? I'm the host of the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show, and also the Total Connector Show, which covers a range of topics. So Guy, thank you so much for your time, and thanks so much for for taking your time. And you're doing really God's work. I'm a huge fan of yours because in thousands of years, or maybe even decades from now on, kids are gonna go to some kind of digital, hyper holographic museum and say, this is Guy who brought in all this content and educated people. So it's you can't appreciate that enough. So thanks so much again.
Yes, absolutely. I'm glad we're doing a joint episode here. I've been meaning to get you on the show, and your Total Bitcoin podcast is the one that I particularly listen to, but you've put out some really awesome work with really awesome interviews in the past, and I assume everybody who listens to my show knows about you, but just in case, it's good to have a chat.
Yeah, definitely. Gee, Guy, I mean, there's so much to talk about, but I thought, as we discussed before we started, I was thinking, because I've been thinking so much about how can we translate, how can we communicate this seemingly complex, world or space around and within Bitcoin, because of course it has so many facets, it has so many aspects, from whatever mathematics, cryptography, game theory, economics, even psychology, spirituality, mushrooms. So there's just so much, but is it it depends all, which dimension are we thinking? Which dimension do we want to communicate, convey values, essence, the bigger picture? And I think there is a way. There's so many brilliant people out there, Bitcoiners or not, who would have the incredible talents, skills, imagination, intelligence, foresight, experience to translate and communicate, to package all this stuff into a movie. I was like, why isn't there still a movie about the central banks? What about, all the criminal centralized entities? Why isn't there? Because how else are we going to reach? I don't want to mate. I'm going to do this now again, officially. I'm going to say this. I told you already, I'm becoming father. We're getting a daughter at the end of December, or maybe even on New Year's Eve 2021.
Congrats.
Yeah, thanks so much. And now Bitcoin has become more than ever the essence of my life, because it's not about Bitcoin, actually. If you think about it thoroughly, it's about this new civilization, this new freedom, this totally unimaginable space we could thrive within. what is, I want to know, what are your thoughts? What have you been like experiencing or contemplating about how can we, you know, advance our knowledge, our empathetic, you know, technological, economical skills to you know, to communicate this bigger picture and then go deeper into the rabbit holes?
Yes. So, one of the things that I think like really positions Bitcoin that it causes such a huge mental shift is that to have your Bitcoin is, and to even understand why its value is almost a form of like radical personal responsibility. And it's one that most people, like, we kind of live in the age of avoiding personal responsibility everywhere we possibly can. Just push it off to the next generation, push it off onto somebody else. It was somebody else's fault that this happened. My bedroom is dirty and miserable because this other person's bedroom is really nice and clean. You know, like it's just look externally and basically point the blame somewhere else. That's kind of like the mental framework that we've been under for a long time. And because of it, I think there's just this massive barrier to breaking out of that line of thinking. But the internet has started to push that forward. This kind of where I think the birth of like long form audio has like really started to come into its own. It's people really rethinking how they look at the world. But there's a really cool point in The Sovereign Individual, a book by, I've forgotten the author's names at the moment.
Moss? No. Mooks? I skimmed over it.
Right.
I even started reading it, but then it was, I don't know, I didn't have the time to finish it. But it's unbelievable, right? The projections and the foresight,
the prescience of what's happening. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there's one really fascinating point that they make in there is that when you're really changing kind of the mental framing of the world, when you're disrupting the old system or the old way of thinking, the old one falls apart. The faith and the trust in the old system breaks down into chaos and confusion before we actually realize the value and find the new one. It's usually in the confusion and in the pressure and in the chaos of the shift, of the transition, that we finally find that new mode of thinking. And I actually think Bitcoin is really at the heart of that. So part of it, I think, is actually just a matter of time, because I think by any, you know, decent, objectionable, like, or objective, like, step back and look at it, I feel like the loss of faith in the old model is kind of apparent. I mean, maybe some people would contest it, but I think if you step back and really just kind of look at it, it's happening. We're watching that right now. And so much of it is so deeply tied to the state of finance and our money. And you know, the financial problems are a consequence of the money. So, and that's not widely known, but I think more and more people are suddenly asking those questions. What does it mean to be given $2,000 out of thin air? Like, what, like, why could that possibly work? People who I would never have thought would ask that question or even be interested in that topic are in fact asking that question now. And Bitcoin exists in that world suddenly, and it's never been, it's kind of like, you know, it's the wild card in this, where suddenly it's a different game being played. Everybody thought we were playing soccer and everybody got good at soccer, and suddenly there's just a whole new game that a couple people are playing. Everybody's confused, don't know what's going on, and they're readjusting whether or not the game that we were all playing before makes any sense to begin with. I think it's baby these steps. It's just keep laying it, because we kind of have the benefit. I don't know if you want to call it a benefit, like, of the fact that we're in this kind of chaotic mode, that the old system is breaking down. I mean, yes, it's good that it's breaking down. No, it's terrible that it comes with a lot of pain and a lot of confusion. But I guess that's inevitable. But because of that, it's like, just lay the seeds. And I think it's going to accelerate really, really fast. Particularly when it does kind of give this sense of, you know, and you know, maybe I'm just coming from my standpoint. I know you probably identify with this just because it's such an exciting and meaningful thing to us. But to compare that to kind of the state of like the normal person, I can't imagine it's anything but like a massive relief to think that, oh, there's this way of thinking that could actually make me excited about today. There's this way of living and looking at the world that actually means that I have huge potential and opportunity, rather than everything's just screwed 10 ways to sideways and there's no opportunity and 2 years from now we're all just gonna die in a big ball of flame. and I think that's what a lot of people think. I mean, I have conversations with friends in the old world. It's just really how I think of it. I genuinely separate the worlds. It's two different ideologies, two different ways of seeing everything. And it's just so depressing and hopeless when I go back to those other people. I mean, they think there's nothing left to invent. Like, I'm just like,
oh my God.
Yes, yes. Like, I just talk to people. It's like, see, oh, you
see how
learn
far
this
the
thing.
Brainwashing goes. I mean, you know,
really?
You know, it's not really? Only like value has been stolen from us for at least 100 years. It's like so much technological innovation, ingenuity. I mean, just talking about Jeff Booth's, you know, book, or, you know, listening to his, you know, to his talks. It's not unimaginable. You know, I mean, where do you think all these trillions have been siphoned off to? At least in the last few decades, you know, why do people you know, finally find out, you know, also through the works of Catherine Austin Fitz. I mean, I'm a huge, you know, fan of her, even though she doesn't understand Bitcoin, but, you know, it's another chapter for itself. So there is already, you know, a huge field of technology, science, innovations out there that just waiting to be unleashed, you know. You know, if we already have like prototypes, and I talked with Jeff Booth about this, like, how can we have like, you know, sort of primitive prototypes of Boston Dynamics robots? They're just sort of as a front, you know, as a front show, but actually in the background, I mean, what do we know? What kind of technology are out there? Who, you know, eventually at the end of the day, these technologies are supposed to serve us, serve humanity. And, you know, so that what? I mean, what is Bitcoin about again? You know, so that we work less, that we have more quality of life, that people do exactly those tasks and, you know, and express those passions that they're really, really, you know, born into actually, but because of this whole, you know, compartmentalized indoctrinated system beginning in kindergarten, in school and universities, we've been all brainwashed. And that's exactly what you've been saying, you know, just previously. You said people are somehow not able to question even, you know, the narrative, the reality, you know, but, and to one more point of yours, you said something like, and I heard, you know, I'm hearing it from a lot of Bitcoiners, and I'm the same, you know. I'm like, if it wasn't for Bitcoin, I think I would be totally depressed. To be honest with you, I would be totally depressed. Because why is it? Because we've understood, we've finally comprehended the root of all the symptoms. We've really faced, we went really down the rabbit hole of all the rabbit holes, and saw whatever the devil, the Satan, into the eyes. And understood the consequences of all of this, and a lot of things, you know, that have been discussed in mainstream and anywhere, and, you know, is actually, it's all symptoms, and this is the problem. We're talking about people keep talking about symptoms. They're still going to the voting booths and voting the same shit, the same political party. It's like, you know, it's like Groundhog Day, you know, it's like every day the same shit, you know. Why don't we just wake up, you know, and vote really with a structural change, you know, with money.
Yeah. And what's kind of the way I think of it is most people don't realize that money is kind of the root of our system. Like, I mean, money is kind of the first piece. It's right up there with, or right back there with language as absolutely core to actually making a society function. And I don't think people just don't realize how far-reaching and multifaceted the effects of minor changes at that level have on everything else. And I kind of see society as this, like we're constantly, like all the media, all of the stuff that we share, we're constantly looking at, there's this huge giant tree that we're a part of. And everybody notices that the leaves are withering, you know, and we're pointing out that, like, look, this whole batch of leaves are kind of like dead and terrible. A lot of these branches are really thin. If the wind blows really hard, we're going to lose a whole lot of like what we've already built here. Like, we just see that, you know, the bark is thin on this part of the tree. Like, we're just pointing out all of these after effects, all of these symptoms, like you say, of so many of the problems and we're rightfully recognizing that these are problems, but we're failing to see that, like, oh, well, if there are any healthy leaves at all, well, we should take it from over there and put it over here. And all the while, our roots are poisoned and we're ignoring it. Everything about how the tree is getting nutrients is corrupted. And yeah. All of it is, if we fix that, we solve 90% of all of the other problems. You know, like, start at the most important thing. You know, if I've got a gunshot wound to my stomach and I've got kind of an infected splinter on my hand, like, yeah, you know, maybe talk about the splinter at some point, but we should deal with the gunshot first. And I feel like that's what we're doing. Everybody's screaming about splinters and, you know, hangnails and all these just dumb little things. And we've been shot multiple times and everybody's ignoring it because it's uncomfortable And it's outside of what we're used to focusing on.
It's beyond schizophrenic. I'm telling you, Guy, it's beyond schizophrenic. This whole, sometimes I'm really, it's like beyond the movie, even Matrix, because it's so insanely sick and so, chaotic and illogical that, you know, it's like the elephant is in the room. We just need to accept it, you know, and to enlighten ourselves. We of course, we need to begin with our own, you know, mindset and behavioral and thought patterns, you know, and comprehension patterns. Sometimes maybe people need to take mushrooms. Seriously, sometimes I'm the opinion that people should take mushrooms, not those that are prone or have the tendency to develop, you know, psychosis and all kinds of, you know, neurological, psychological problems. But I think because it's been so stigmatized and the scientific fraud has been going on for so many decades, you know, I think it needs sometimes this for some people it just wouldn't help. I think on the Joe Rogan show I heard a guy expert say Donald Trump, I'm not a fan, I'm not a friend of Donald Trump, but I'm just saying maybe there's some people who it wouldn't make sense to give him any kind of psilocybin or LSD or ayahuasca, DMT or something. But I'm just what I'm getting at is like we need to change our own perception. You know, and sometimes look from the different angles and perspectives and you know, the solution is right there in front of us. The elephant is in the room. And everything else, as you said, is going to just be resolved by itself, whether it be environmental problems, inequality, sickness, diseases. We could even, you know, extend our lifespan. It's all possible. Energy efficiency, energy conversion, transportation technologies. This is just the tip of the iceberg, what we're seeing with Elon Musk, Tesla. This is nothing. We're still burning fuel. And I'm telling you, we could already, you know, have totally different technologies out there that would resolve everything, even the environmental problems, the contamination, everything else.
Yeah, there's a really interesting, was it Danny Hillis or Rosen, God, I can't remember who it was. I'll see if I can't find the source of this, and I'll put it in the show notes when I post this on my feed. But there are a couple of things that I've read in the past about kind of the progress of innovation and technology, and how if you go through periods like, excuse me, like the Great Depression, and like really destitute periods during, Civil War, World War II, like all these huge events in history where it seems like we lost the ability to innovate, or like markets were incredibly stagnant and
Oh,
stuff
I think
that.
I know what you're talking about. Is that the study also cited by Safed Namouz in his book, The Bitcoin Standard, on page 96, I think 98,
Maybe.
where he cites, maybe it's something similar. It says Jonathan Huebner, a possible declining trend for worldwide innovation, and he and Safed Namouz compares the 19th and 20th century 0 to 1 sort of technological innovation, original or innovation, and everything else that after the gold standard, sort of after the decoupling from the gold standard, it was all fucked up. It was all like optimization improvements, but not really like original, really ingenious innovations.
Yes. Now here's a really fascinating part of that is that it's less about the fact that the innovations didn't happen and more about the fact that the innovations don't progress on the market. And that's what was actually seen during like the 30s is that you would think the Great Depression would slow down the capacity for new technology and it would slow down innovation, but the reality is that it really didn't change very much, but we didn't have a healthy market to actually put it out and make it available to people. So what happened is that the bridge or the gap between those who could access the most important new innovations and those who couldn't and who were stuck in the old world just got bigger and bigger and bigger. But then after you get through that, there's an explosion where all those innovations finally spread out. And I actually think this is what we've seen today is we have a very stagnant economy because of the imbalances in money and finance have propped up investments in stuff that's out of date, stuff that's unbelievably inefficient, stuff that's just burning through money. We have multi-billion dollar companies who have stock prices go up 10 to 20% a year who have never turned a profit, who have literally are consuming resources. They're not producing productive value. The whole point of producing a profit is to basically prove and know that what you are consuming, you're producing more at the other end. If everybody's running a deficit, it just means that we're going to eat everything up and then run out of all of it. That's what that means. And that's what we're doing. We are propping up these zombies that aren't actually productive. And COVID, the chaos that has resulted from that has actually started the push to spread information and to spread technology that has been here, that's been waiting for 20 years for people to actually utilize. And people just haven't gotten over the hump. They've just been like, I'll do it tomorrow. Like we're just kind of in this huge constant state of like, I know we got to do it, but maybe next week. It's like this still works right now, and I'm still making money off of this, so let's just not worry about it. And because of that, we've never had that pressure to change. But this is such a great example because we've seen, I mean, what's been the explosion in homeschooling? What, look at the explosion of people finally going remote,
It's become
of
more
remote.
important to me. And Daniel Prince is, I think, not only a huge advocate, but a huge expert because he's got his kids of his own, and he does even podcasts on homeschooling. So this is going to become even more important to me and my girlfriend, since we're going to get our baby. And I think I'm not going to let anybody brainwash our daughter. I'm not going to send her to school.
Amen.
Yes, seriously, I mean, I was thinking even to emigrate, but it's just so difficult to emigrate to Paraguay, because this is now I understand why so many people emigrate even from Germany and other countries to Paraguay. I met some people, families in Paraguay, because they didn't want to send their kids to school. Isn't that crazy? I mean, it's
Yeah, that's nuts.
And you just see, you know, the other side, and there's a documentary called Alphabet where you see sort of the total the total opposite sides of homeschooled children and children who are like totally compartmentalized and pressurized in, you know, in schools everywhere, all around the globe, and you see these kids like homeschool, like totally creative, like, you know, intelligent and with awesome skills. It's amazing how children can evolve and prosper and flourish, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a totally different mindset. Because you think about like school, I mean, schooling could not be a better example of one of those things. That's just an absolute resource suck. Like it's a black hole of useful, productive things and destroys them. And all you have to do is look at the price to even like realize it and compare it. The price of higher education since the year 2000 has tripled. This is the age where you can learn anything you want on YouTube for free. Does it really cost three times the amount of man hours, three times the amount of buildings and books from 20 years ago to actually educate somebody? No, absolutely not. It doesn't. I can learn anything I want on my own time at home for free, literally anything. It's a little harder if I take the free route, but if I spend $200, I can get a completely curated, step-by-step, entertaining version of it, and I can get one-on-one work with somebody. Like, you can get that for such low cost, it's unbelievable, but we still send kids to a school that cost $15,000, $16,000, $17,000 a year, so that they segment.
Yeah,
they can stay at their parents' home,
you know, and have a fucked up quality of life. I mean, what kind of reality is this? Seriously. And before I forget this point, I wanted it was pretty important. It was about technological innovation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you know Per Billund? I had him on my show too. He's an awesome economist, also a scholar of entrepreneurship, Austrian economics. Per Billund, is he from Sweden? I'm not sure. One of those Scandinavian countries. And
I'm not sure. I'll look that episode up.
It was really interesting. He said, because I always said, you know, this whole patent system is such an evil system because, you just lock in all these technological innovations. Of course, I mean, I understand that, you know, the entrepreneurs, not the entrepreneurs, the inventors, these ingenious minds that somehow, you know, develop something, invent something. Of course, they want to be compensated. And either, you know, they get pressurized, you know, into selling their, you know, their intellectual ideas, sort of the intellectual properties, and then lock it up. And then nothing happens, of course, you know, and I don't want to know how many thousands and maybe tens of thousands technological innovations have to be just locked up in a closet,
yeah,
you know, or seized in the name of national security or whatever, you know, maybe a solar panel that have like 40% to 50% more efficiency, you know, it's just an example as a tip of the iceberg. But and he said something about the intellectual properties, as he said, is actually a hindrance to technological innovation. That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
So, no, it definitely is. I totally agree with that. And one of the things, and you can actually see this with something like open source, is that the progress of innovations and iterations on open source, the focus is actually better. What's funny is that you get a lot of quote unquote innovation with the patent system, but what you get is arbitrary innovation. Yeah. What you get is innovation around manipulating the patent system, around making sure that I've got something that is that solves the same problem a little bit differently and just differently enough that I can get a patent on it. But they're not worried. They're not thinking about solving the problem better. They're not thinking about foundational changes. They're thinking about how do I get something that can have a different patent on it so I can extend my monopoly on this solution. And it's funny how much like people talk about, like I said, open source is just a great example of the exact opposite principle producing unbelievable results, is that the engineers and the people actually solving the problems are solving their own problems. They're solving something that they know they need fixed, and they are iterating with direct feedback from the people who are using it. And it starts from something that really gets at the heart of solving the problem and doing it as efficiently and with as little. It's kind of the worse is better, like GWERN, like concept of like Linux philosophy or whatever. Like, do it. Don't solve every possible problem and make an end product that's just the best product ever. Solve the most important problem as efficiently and as cleanly as you can, and then build off from that. Solve half the problem perfectly, and then start and then continue to iterate, and let the actual community, let the people who are using the product, give you feedback and tell you the direction to let it to evolve it going forward. And that is, that whole design system actually works because it's open source. It doesn't even work in a closed, like monopolistic, like walled garden sense around patenting a design. But it's actually focused right. Whereas again, the patent system gives the perception that, oh my God, we've got 3,000 new innovations this year, when really the truth is 2,999 of them are completely pointless. They're just a way to make a new patent on something and not really change how we're solving the problem. And one of the things that like really gets me is the endless that some of those we're never rethinking the foundations. Never are we thinking about how do we redesign this from the bottom up to really, really solve these problems. Like, everybody talks about like universal healthcare, and that like, you know, the government should spend $43 trillion to give everybody a personal doctor in their home to rub their feet. And not one of them would consider, well, why don't we just anything that's medically related, get rid of patents? You would cut the price of every one of those things by 95% in like 4 months.
Right.
Like the prices would just plummet across the board if you got rid of medical patents. If this thing is necessary to sustaining life and keeping people alive, nobody should have a monopoly on that.
Yeah.
If you want to do that.
Or if you want to go into the other direction, like alternative health medicine, we want to talk about cannabis. Okay. I mean, because it's just started a new podcast series, because my girlfriend has a grow shop, you know, she's an engineer from chemical background, and she's really expert in growing plants, like cannabis plants. And so I've been doing, you know, a lot of interviews with doctors who are ethical, you know, who are really like committed to the Hippocratic Oath, you know, like really want to help and heal patients. And they're saying, this is so fucked up and ridiculous. Why didn't you just, legalize and regulate it correctly, ethically, rationally? Because there are more than 2 million, alone in Austria, where I live, you know, there are more than 2 million pain patients. And, you know, we can just forget, you know, now we know why, partially, the essential reason why cannabis is still illegal, because you can't put a patent on a plant which has holistic properties, you know, hundreds and hundreds of healing properties of cannabidiols or whatever, you know. So it just, again, you talked about foundational structural changes, transformational changes. This is what we need. And this is why I think we have so much trust in the Bitcoin space. We have so much conviction and trust in the power and the potential and the essence in the real super, you know, spectrum of Bitcoin, because it solves everything at the root level.
Sponsor break, mofos. We'll be back in a second. Yeah. And painkillers are such a good example. Such a good example of the poison of the patent system is that we have simple, holistic, has worked for thousands of years sort of options that nobody can patent. And instead, we get a new painkiller every year and a new patent. Like, that's the very definition of, we already got this problem really kind of sorted out, and we don't need to waste another $100 billion on solving this problem again and again. It's like people just reinventing the wheel over and over again. Mine has a little bit more curvature over on these sides. Like, it's just reiterating the same thing rather than like building off of a foundation of something that's cheap, affordable, and open, but they can't make margins on it. They can't if they can't hold a monopoly on it, if they can't hold that patent, then their margins are 0.5%, 1%. tops because they're open to all of this competition. Anybody can produce it. So the idea is, well, let's make a new thing with a new patent, change it just enough that it's something unique. We'll ignore the fact that we've just added 10 really terrible side effects, and we'll just make sure we say that at like a million miles a minute at the end of the commercial with somebody smiling, walking through a meadow. And then we get to sell it at a 80% markup because we have the patent and nobody else can do it. And that's what we have. That's like kind of a microcosm of the whole economy right now. We're doing that everywhere. And it's not obviously not just the patents. It's kind of the makeup of how bad all of our allocation of resources are. And it's because we don't have real prices. It's because our money,
there is no price discovery.
It's meaningless.
I mean, come on, if that ain't like super central planned communism just disguised as whatever. I mean,
capitalism.
There is no capital, there is no free market. If we had something like that, if we have real sound true money like Bitcoin,
it's gonna force so much change that has been needing to happen for a long time. Jeff Booth, like you said in his book, Price of Tomorrow, that's such a great example. Mm-hmm. Like he just talks about like because technology is moving so quickly, basically what we have done is we have tried to, it's like, you know, the ocean is coming in and we're trying to build up walls as quick as we can.
Yeah, yeah. He compared it to gravity, you know, like central banks, governments are trying to fight gravity.
Yeah. They're trying as hard as they can to swim against the current. We are fighting tooth and nail, and it's costing us everything to pretend that this massive force of deflation isn't here. And we have pushed in the absolute wrong direction and grown one of the most just monumental imbalances in the history of mankind for 40 years, 50 years. I mean, it's astronomical. It's extraordinary in the degree of like how great it is. Like, yes, it's terrible, but it's also just like, holy shit. Like, look at what actually, it's kind of a feat. At the same time that it's a horrible feat, it's still amazing that such a huge imbalance and misallocation has happened during such a strong push in the opposite direction. But the further we go in the wrong direction, just the harder the fall, you know? And that's what I think we're witnessing is that the deflationary push, what Jeff Booth says in the thing is like, at some point we have to let go. We have to realize that we can't fight this. All we do is just completely obliterate our money in our effort to pretend this doesn't exist. But this is feedback. Like, hard to comprehend how strong these feedback loops are. And even in the spite of our terrible money, you look at all of the things that have deflated at a staggering pace. Like information technology is eating everything. Everything is becoming a computer. Everything is now producing data. And this is not going to slow down. This is speeding up now. And now we're finding new ways to it used to be like kind of hardware and the digital world was kind of separate from the physical. And now we are getting to the point where we are teaching that software to look at and optimize the physical world for us. That we are getting it to see it can read the traffic faster and better than we can. It can know the environment and adapt to it and tell us what the best route for doing A, B, or C is in this environment or in this location. We're getting it to map the world for us so that we can make even better decisions. And that's going to accelerate on itself yet again. It's going to get worse. Yeah. Well, quote unquote, better in the fact that like meaningfully better in productivity and value, but worse in the sense that deflation is going to get out of control. And it's going to be the point where we will fight until everything just collapses and all we can do is just fall into the water and let the current push us where we're going to go. But we could actually change. Bitcoin is a great example of just letting it ride, of being like, all right, well, let's
let's, rather than waiting until this whole thing collapses and we're, you know, in the water, in the rubble while we're rushing in, while the tide is rushing in, how about we build a surfboard and we get up on top of it and we just ride this thing and have fun?
Because that's the key question. How are we going to transition, right? Yeah. How fast can we transition if it happens suddenly? You know, it's not going to be gradually for, you know, all of us. You know, all of a sudden it's not going to be gradually. It's going to be so suddenly and so unexpectedly. And now let's talk about this. Guy, I mean, because I was going to ask you, like, what do you see, what do you foresee as a, like, transitional phases, like, would it be the critical adoption rate of Bitcoin, the hype inflation? I mean, if we just look at the data, look at the numbers, look at the prices of gold, even silver, you know, which is like, you know, total elastic production that you know, you could just, it's like copper probably, but it doesn't matter, you know, but it's like the quiet before the storm. Like, do you see, all of a sudden, maybe, you know, hyperinflationary countries, those that are, you know, under sanctions or embargoes, adopt Bitcoin all of a sudden, and because of, you know, competitive mining, Bitcoin mining, and you know, because of existential threat, you know.
I think it's going to be a little bit of everything. We like to kind of look at history as like key moments, and you know, these like, oh, this government adopted Bitcoin and that was, you know, what changed things. But I actually think it's going to be kind of a infiltration of all of it all at once. Mm-hmm. And it's slowly going to start to eat 1% of, you know, governments having a reserve, because, you know, another domino of hyperinflationary currency falls. And I think fiat is in exactly that state of kind of dominoes falling, is there so many that are primed for a terrible move in the opposite direction out because of these debt imbalances, because of these obligations that the only option is to print money to cover. Basically, they've made 100x the promises that anybody could ever even hope to afford. And in doing so, those will start to push peer-to-peer markets. That's what we've seen with like things like Paxful and stuff. I'm not sure if you saw, I think Marty Bent posted it, and I still didn't look up his name. I've talked about him like a couple of times, but in the Bitcoin magazine Drinks in Quarantine, the guy who heads Paxful was talking about how the peer-to-peer market volume has exploded in like 10 or 12 countries. And that's one of those things where as soon as the people start to realize that they need to get exposed to Bitcoin and they need to start using Bitcoin, that's going to start to accelerate without a doubt. I think governments, particularly ones who are trying to shore up their currency or save their own ability to purchase things, will start to buy Bitcoin and start to hold Bitcoin. I think we're already seeing them move into gold at an increasing rate, which is a recognition that hard money is absolutely a necessity to kind of the next stage of things. I think I'm not so certain that we'll see a collapse of fiat currencies at the scale that most people think. I think hyper-Bitcoinization may actually happen as a consequence of trying to prevent the collapse of these currencies, because at the end of the day, governments will do what makes them survive. They are ultimately greedy and self-centered, and they're going to, if Bitcoin is going to make their currency better, they'll let it happen. And I think that is something, that's where the US, all the nonsense aside, and all the corruption and unbelievable imbalances that we have aside, the U.S. citizenry, like the country itself, the people in it, not the political apparatus, has more Bitcoin than any other geographic location, any other like individual population. And that's actually a good sign that the economy, like even if, you know, the government implodes or like 90% of what it does falls apart, that the economy could actually survive, that there's actually something to pull us out of the quicksand when the shit really hits the fan, which maybe now, I'm not sure. I still think it's going to get worse before it gets better. But I've been trying to, I've gone through my head and like done a lot of reading and investigating other countries because I'm kind of in that same situation. It's like, is it a good idea to be here? Because there's some really nasty looking potential for the future. But what's going to weather the storm the best? Because there is a storm coming. And so I've thought about, like, do we go through all that trouble leaving the country? Do we at least leave that on the table? Like, what's the short list of where we might go?
No, and seriously, I mean, look at the United States alone. I mean, the number of unemployment applications, I think it rose to 50 million. The number of insolvencies, the people that is mm-hmm. in the tens of millions who are not going to be able to pay the mortgages, pay the rents. People are broke. And what are you going to do with these people? I mean, if that ain't like the fertile ground for civil war, I don't know what, you know. And that's just United States. And let's not talk about even the European Union, where experts, serious, credible, even Austrian economists and experts over here, you know, who don't even have anything to do with Bitcoin, say the euro is going to crash by the end of the year. With it this year and next year, it doesn't matter anymore. Like, it's going to be a war. You know, I think it's going to be civil war, and this is what I'm really concerned about. Like, who is in control here? You know, of the military-industrial complex, of the, of all the centralized structures. Like, what's going to happen then? You know, are people going to be able to feed themselves, defend themselves? What about these people? You know, so
that's why
I'd rather be on the countryside, to be honest with you.
Yeah. But that's actually one thing why I think a kind of a framing for Bitcoin is that it is a tool for self-defense. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's going to be a prime, I guess you could say, meme that's stuck in people's heads, is that how do I defend myself? Like, how do I protect my family, my wealth, all of the things that are at stake now? And most people haven't had to deal with that. Like, most people haven't had to ask that question before in the US and in much of the modern world, really. But they're going to have to. And what's funny is that, like, all of this stuff with the protests, with the police just abandoning things, with businesses just getting wiped out downtowns all across the country in major cities, just windows broken, buildings burned. Raleigh, the downtown just out here, was just obliterated. I think we've had a stronger push for the Second Amendment as we've ever had in this country. Like anybody who says that, like, oh, you shouldn't be able to have a gun to protect yourself because the police will protect you, I think is pissing into the wind. They're at this point, anybody with half a brain cell is going to be like, yeah, that's retarded. Like, because 90% of the people who say that are the same ones who say the police are abusive, we should defund the police.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, so they're the ones that are going to protect us. But 20 seconds ago, you just told me they're the ones that you can't depend on, exactly, that are evil, that are Nazis, and we should not pay them anything. It's like, okay. Like, you know, we kind of live in the age of contradiction.
And the gun owners, you know, and that's a good thing. I mean, if you had asked me like a couple of decades ago, like what I think about weapons, I had a totally different like position and line of thoughts but now, you know, because I understand, you know, the total abuse, the criminality of the, you know, whatever central bank structure, nation states, government, mm-hmm. the police forces, the militarized police, especially these, you know, it's a bunch of thugs. And on the other hand, you know, it's good that people, especially in the United States, are actually outnumbering the people, you know, outnumbering the police, you know, in terms of, you know, holding guns and being able to defend themselves, you know, talking about the amendment. So Second Amendment. So, yeah, it's good. It's a good thing, you know, that. And I think it could be maybe the only viable solution to prevent the civil war, or to, you know, not, you know, have it break out in chaos, because there's going to be an equilibrium.
Yeah, I think balkanization, the breakdown into local communities and relying on each other, like leaning on each other and actually getting to know your neighbors and having the city, having the neighborhood manage this, that, or the other. I think that's the way out of this. And I think there's actually the guy who was on TFTC. I haven't listened to this book yet, but Strong Towns is basically
Krieger, Michael Krieger.
Is that his name?
Liberty Blitz, something like that. Liberty Blitz. Or something
that sounds
like
that. Right.
Yeah,
that
he's great. Right. Yeah, I had him on my show. He's great. Yeah, you should have him.
Oh yeah, yeah, awesome. That's I really think that's the kind of way that things are going. And what's funny is that that's one of those things that Bitcoin really, really promotes. And it doesn't. It's obviously not like a. It's not an explicit promotion, but it's something that destroys the economies of scale of finance, mm-hmm. in a sense, of like that monetary system, and pulls it all the way back to the individual. I just read a piece yesterday on the show about comparing Lightning as against the current global payment system, like the retail payment system, and how Lightning could actually evolve. And what's funny is one of the things he alluded to was the idea of community-run Lightning nodes that were like microservices, where everybody basically, you have 30, 40 people essentially open up their own bank. And they help manage, they have close relationships with each other. So they know, like, you can actually build a good, high reputation, trusted economy on top of this trustless money, and that these barriers to banking and licensing and all these things, and the barriers to accessing Fedwire, which is, you know, maybe 1,000 banks, and you have to have a banking license. You know, the barrier there is multiple years, tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions of dollars in resources and political connections. That's the barrier to having a monetary settlement.
Yeah, we should give at this point, like, give a shout out to, because I just listened to some presentation or talks by Catherine Woods and Caitlin Long. You tweeted about it. It's like, if you connect those two talks, you see, really, you become so optimistic, so positive. It's like, wow. I mean, if that is the case, you know, especially in Wyoming, they've already, I mean, they're literally structurally, is, you know, considered, they've already seceded from the United States, because they've got their own, like, super regulated, super, like, thought, you know, everything is thought through. And there you go. You know, as you said, you know, about this whole Lightning Network and localized, whatever, economies or, it's all, you know, there you go, you know, with this pseudo argument or counter argument against, you know, you know, Bitcoin is not gonna make it with their throughput numbers and, you know, blockchain size and all this bullshit that's been propagated all these years, right? So there you go, right? So you got especially, I'm really excited when Jack Mallers' strike is going to come out, also in European Union, because there, you know, then you have a really super user-friendly technology and application with I'm assuming it's really, at least to a certain degree.
Oh yeah, it is.
With full privacy, you know, and anonymity for a lot of people, so they can make microtransactions. So all these things gonna come simultaneously, I think.
Yeah, the privacy aspect, like Strike obviously does have KYC, AML, like that sort of thing, because that's kind of inevitable with a company that's dealing in dollars. It's a perfect example. First off, the user interface and the user experience is unbelievable.
Have you tested it yourself? Have you tested it?
Yes. Yeah, I've been using it for a while.
Okay, cool.
I originally was only testing it actually by depositing by Lightning as soon as he opened that up, because my bank, I couldn't connect it to my bank. PNC is garbage. And in fact, I'm actually probably the first thing I do after this is I actually have escalated it finally. After talking to like 4 or 5 people, I've finally gotten it to someone who even knows what the hell an API is, to actual tech person at PNC. And I need to call them back. So hopefully, fingers crossed, I might actually get that dealt with. But I had to open up a whole new account at a whole different bank. just to use Strike. And I've been physically going to the bank, getting out cash and then depositing the other one so that I can use Strike because I just wanted to use it that bad. But originally I was actually just depositing with Lightning. And you know, if like Bitcoin spiked a little bit, I'd just deposit a little bit in case it actually dipped. I was using it kind of like as a, I could do like a little micro trade, you know, just to see, cause I'm holding it in dollars in Strike, but I can pay any invoice anywhere. And that's kind of where the privacy side of it is. Is Strike doesn't know what they're paying for on your behalf.
Okay.
So they're just using Lightning and Bitcoin as the payment rails. And this is very much in line with the article that I was just talking about. It's written by Nicholas Berte and Chris Hunter from Galloway Money, which is new. They don't have like their products and stuff out yet. So they're still like small on Twitter, Galloway is, but I'm very, very curious what they're building after reading a number of their articles. Apparently they have built a alpha wallet of a non-custodial wallet and then a custodial one, just to kind of give the feel, get the feel of working with and building both of those products on Lightning. And their assessment, what they say in the article, is basically even in its current state, Lightning can be, Lightning and Bitcoin together has the capacity to build out and with liquidity or whatever to replace the current global financial payment system. That Bitcoin is, Bitcoin handles as much as Fedwire does, actually. Which is a tidbit that I love to mention to people, is that it can actually settle as many explicit transactions as Fedwire does. And in fact, it's catching up. Like, not only is it a very small margin, but Bitcoin is continuing to increase. And with efficiency and stuff on chain, things like Taproot and the ability to hide signatures and do multi-sig and multiple input to output and increase in batching and stuff, I think it will pass Fedwire. Probably in kind of a major way. But with Lightning Network, Lightning is the perfect way to onboard new payment services and ones that can actually do so non-custodially, which is something that current payment infrastructure does not, has absolutely no capacity to do. You can't have a non-custodial dollar payment service. You know, you can't, Visa can't be non-custodial. This is the only way that it could possibly work.
Not to mention reverse chargeback and all this bullshit.
Yeah, all that stuff. And they literally say Lightning can work now. And like, and it would be a massive improvement over our old, over the old system. It says, but like, pause that and then think about the fact that you've got an open source environment, thousands of developers working on this, completely permissionless innovation. Somebody can build a groundbreaking app by themselves with no banking license, no asking for permission, no needing like just basic gRPC and the REST API tools that tens of millions of developers already know back, like the back of their hands, like just basic dirt simple stuff from a development perspective, can create an app or a payment service that is an absolute game changer and doesn't have any of the issues or barriers to the walled gardens that we are used to, like PayPal, Venmo's, Cash App, and that sort of thing. And that is, like, just that alone. Take out all the facts that you can, it's an HTLC, man. You can put any, you can put hundreds of different features and multi-sigs and potential for reversing the transaction for a day, you know, holdable HTLCs, keysend, and you can build encrypted apps, encrypted chat apps on top of it, and that you could do micropayments for decentralized servers. All the problems with like IPFS and actually maintaining a decentralized set of servers to store information are around the fact that finance is so closed off that you can't fund it. Mm-hmm. Now we have an open source, completely low barrier payments, micropayment system
that can handle literally like tens of millions transactions. That's
yes.
About it. Within,
and now you
like
can
fraction of
do
a second,
like
probably,
that.
You know?
Yeah. And that's like the number of things that that will enable. And I think that's where kind of we're going is, that Bitcoin is going to start to enable so many novel new things. First, it will just start to become an infrastructure inversion. And then we will realize that there are these potential things to build on top of it that are stateless, that are global, that have no borders, and where somebody in the most despotic, under the most despotic regime anywhere in the world can still just log into a service in North Carolina and have full access to a global banking infrastructure that doesn't even matter if their government says no, they just log in with a VPN and they have it, and they have access to a global, like, insanely low friction economy.
Yeah, and on top of that, if you just think the independence from the internet, like people like Alexander Cesere, Randy Brito of Lodger Mesh, Richard Myers of Global Mesh Network. I mean, if we can bring like independence from the internet with whatever, like Blockstream Green, you know, Adam Back and his satellite kit, if this becomes like super user friendly as a super small kit that you just plug in and you have super privacy and super independence from the internet, like in countries like whatever, Iran or wherever, you know, I mean, this is the people who's going to benefit eventually. Yeah. You know,
and all you need is one bridge.
Right.
To the rest.
This is really exciting. This is one of the most exciting, because then finally we have a totally detached system, you know, from the conventional centralized, you know, criminal structures. Let me just go to the we wanted to talk about the great wealth transfer, because there came this report. I mean, you know, if it wasn't for the bright, you know, ethical individuals working in these institutions, such as Pierre Rochard at Kraken, because I'm still a fan of Kraken because of their, let's say, service, and but because of the shitcoinery, they have a little bit lost, a lot of credibility from me. It doesn't matter. The title of this report, it's called Inheriting U.S. Dollars and Acquiring Bitcoins, How the Great Wealth Transfer Will Fuel the Great Bitcoin Adoption. And without going into too much detail, you can read it for yourself. We can maybe put the link online. It says here, just the numbers are really interesting. It says here, by the same token, the data has yet to suggest that Bitcoin is doing anything but evolving, maturing, and gaining global recognition. It is with the passing of more than $68 trillion in wealth over the next few decades that we expect Bitcoin to prosper from a multi-generational shift, meaning from baby boomers, boomers, whatever, to the millennials and Generation X. Multi-generational shift of wealth, beliefs, desires, and expectations. And of course, this study, this report is pretty conservative, very, you know, focused on the United States. But still, if you just, you know, like zoom out, like, and consider the dynamic factors and the processes taking place globally, then you can see the real potential for the unexpected Bitcoin's mass adoption. All things considered, it says the idea of more than $1 trillion, which is nothing, of wealth flowing into Bitcoin over the next 25 years is perhaps more conservative than outlandish, and its impact would undoubtedly be historic. So just going to, you know.
Yes. Yeah, well, I had Pete on the show to talk about that specifically, because I think I mentioned this prior to getting into this, was that piece is really, really good. But it's data heavy, so it reads in audio a little awkwardly. It's just like one number after the other, and then there's like a big chart, and it's like I can't. It's hard to just be like, oh, all the things are going up on the chart. I had him on the show, and we talked all about it. But that was a great piece. I kind of feel the same way about Kraken. It's like it's the more. It's a shitcoin casino where they're at least doing productive work, and they understand and look at Bitcoin properly, even though they're selling casino points. they have done some pretty amazing work as far as like their reports and stuff, because I'm always digging in and reading any of that stuff that I can get my hands on. That one in particular is really good. And the key takeaway is how shockingly conservative that estimate is.
Wow.
And that's what's most amazing about that, is that they're talking about, okay, $1 trillion is going to move into Bitcoin over the next 25 years. But when you look at how they came up with that number, first, it's just the US. This is not the globe. This is 100% the US. Two, this is with the current investment makeup of Generation X and millennials. Mm-hmm. So this is how they currently invest. and assuming that they will still only do, I can't remember what the percent, it was like 5% is in digital assets or something.
Right.
That's not going to increase to 6% or 7% over the next 20 years. That they're still going to be in stocks and bonds and housing at the same rate that they are. And then it's also that only that portion of the 68 trillion that's going, moving from the boomer generation down in inheritance is explicitly what moves into Bitcoin. And it's ignoring feedback loops, ignoring the fact that there's going to be an entirely new and separate economy, ignoring the fact that Bitcoiners are building crap like crazy and demand could absolutely skyrocket, ignoring the fact that if this money starts to move into it and you double the price, you get double the eyes suddenly looking at it going, why was I not in this? And that the boomers themselves that are left over might start investing in it. Ignore everything about what might change, and you still are looking at $1 trillion moving into Bitcoin.
Oh my God, that's really super conservative. I mean, just they haven't probably
painfully.
I'm sure they haven't even considered the unexpected like capital escape. Like, what are you going to do with whatever inflation, hyperinflation, crash, euro crash? People are just going to flock to Bitcoin. They're just going to like moths,
And that's what Pete says too. Is that like we literally went out of our way to see what they kind of wanted to get a minimum, Like, what can we say confidently that no questions asked, like, take everything as static? What could we see move into Bitcoin? And that's kind of the most shocking part of it, is just that you're looking at that much capital as kind of a, like, minimum, like lowest common denominator of what could occur. And, you know, you're already talking about $50,000, $60,000 of Bitcoin with, trillion, $1.2 trillion market.
Drop on a hot stone. Yeah, it's nothing.
Nothing. So you just begin to really, you see so clearly, like, the overwhelming potential that this has to just suck up value. Because as soon as you start putting in the network effect and the idea of the shelling point, like, Bitcoin is going to be the digital currency. Like, 2017 was really the year that it came into everyone's consciousness, and it became a household name. 2020 and 2021 will be the years that Bitcoin becomes something that you must have some of. It will go from, yeah, I heard about that Bitcoin thing, to, yeah, I know I gotta get some. I just don't quite know how yet, and can you help me? I really think that is this stage, is that if you, I think at 2022, 2023, if you don't have some exposure of to Bitcoin, you're going to look like a fool. You're going to look like a dinosaur.
Yeah, and that's it's what going Paul Tudor Jones, and all these entrepreneurs, macro investors say, it's actually irresponsible not to have, a certain piece of that cake. It's totally irresponsible. And not to mention the, again, the halving and the whatever wants to think about the stock to flow ratio. There's all this discussion about plan Bs, but eventually it's about the network effect, the exponential network effect, people coming in at by order of magnitude into this, the scarcest money, and by 2024, is that the next halving? Where's the stock flow ratio going to be? Not to mention that the Sharpe ratio is going to be like off the charts, and the stock to flow ratio is going to be definitely beyond gold, but somewhere between 80 or 100 or something.
A stock to flow for gold, I think right now, the 60. Price is going up, so it will, I think it's still around 60, but production will actually increase because of the increase in the price.
Yeah.
And this is something that's really common. You can actually see the stock to flow can actually go down because whenever gold is doing good, because it actually allows people to put more resources into mining it. And if you mine it a whole lot harder, you actually get more gold. If you mine Bitcoin harder, you don't get any more Bitcoin.
Right. This is what gold bugs don't get, and Peter Schiff doesn't get. It's relative scarce, and we don't know, how much gold there is out there, or underneath the oceans, or on the moon, or on the asteroids, or anywhere, or you just need a new technological innovation where you can extract much more efficiently, or maybe you can seriously with subnuclear technology, plasma technology, you could. And
that's the thing that I always bring up is even outside of the kind of more outlandish scenarios of, oh, we'll mine, maybe we'll find some on the moon, or we'll mine an asteroid or something, which I think is outlandish, yes, but it's still realistic. In the realm of possible. I think it's absolutely real, particularly when we have a satellite or a machine that can go up and just do it for us. Mm-hmm. And like, we don't have to send people, you know, like, yeah, that's not even close to really out of the question. It's just a matter of like, is it worth it to go do that? The cost. And that's where, like, if gold has already been through its monetization event, you know, like gold has been there for thousands and thousands of years. So it just doesn't have much upside in purchasing power.
Right.
It has upside in not losing purchasing power to fiat. But the big thing is, if its purchasing power specifically ever did go up, like let's say dollar value is static and then gold goes up to $20,000 an ounce, what you're actually looking at is that suddenly it becomes, we can do things like irradiate lead and mercury and turn it into gold. It just takes a ton of energy. It costs, you know,
with
maybe
today's technology, let's say.
With,
you know,
today's technology.
We don't know
technology.
What's going to happen in 10 or 20 years, you know, what kind of technologies we're going to have, you know.
Exactly.
Would it be, you know, like, it's all about conversion of energy, you know, would it be magnetical gravitational field strength or electromagnetic, you know, subnuclear conversion energy. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. This is what I'm saying. Like, who is in control? All this, you know, military industrial corporate complex, where are the trillions been flowing into? You know, which haven't been disclosed, you know.
Just, yeah, there's a lot of that too.
Yeah.
But if you look at gold, I mean, excuse me, if you look at Bitcoin, one of the things I kind of love about the going to 2024 having is that the stock to flow, the actual production, you know, versus the stock of Bitcoin will actually cross gold's before the halving, because, you know, for that whole 4-year period, there's a static increase. So we're increasing the amount of Bitcoin that exists, but we're not increasing the amount that we're producing. So we're actually really close to gold right now, but we're inching closer to it every time we produce a new block. And we'll actually, if gold's production doesn't increase or decrease, if it just kind of stays static, which I think we probably could expect it to increase, and maybe it's even sooner. But we could see gold's, you know, towards the end of 2023, Bitcoin would surpass gold scarcity. And after it surpasses it, it never goes back. Like there's no reversing of that. Like it's going to, not only will it go past it, but it will accelerate massively, because we'll be right before a halving, and then we'll double the stock to flow, and we'll be doing it again and again. And it's going to get crazy. We don't really know. It's kind of like that deflationary push that Jeff Booth talks about in his book, is that we don't quite understand what it means to have something that scarce. We've genuinely never had anything like that as a widely available permissionless market good, particularly with not the other elements of money like fungibility and divisibility and portability, like all those other like massive benefits to it, just having something that scarce.
And like that cannot ever be diluted, manipulated, and controlled, because it's really literally not controlled by anyone, you know?
Yeah.
It's just crazy. About the access to the keys of, you know, but actually it's somewhere out there in the, what do you want to call it, the ether, in the space, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think the cat is out of the bag. The Pandora's box been opened like for a long time, and it's super decentralized. You know, it's been freed. The money has been freed. The only thing that's needed right now is a super like collective consciousness, like a critical consciousness, you know, that just adopts it, you know, starts adopting it.
And like I said, I think that will be a gradually then suddenly thing. Like, people will begin to realize that they'll lose faith in the old system, and then they'll start looking for the new, and that will steamroll really, really hard. Corey Clipston, from Swan Bitcoin CEO, has a great piece that I read on the show called The Intransigent Minority.
Read it, yeah.
And we will reach that point where there are enough people who see the world through the Bitcoin lens, that understand the problems through the Bitcoin lens, and are avid promoters, avid believers in Bitcoin, that it will be this constant nagging presence in everyone who still sees negativity, who still sees no hope, thinks that all the things have been invented, there's nothing left to discover. When I think we're literally the exact opposite. We've never had more tools at our hands to discover more things or invent more things ever in the history of the world. Not only do I see it as there's nothing left to discover, there's more to discover today than there has ever been ever accessible to us. I think exactly. The exact opposite is the truth, which right. just blows my mind that somebody could be so hopeless. Right. But
and I think he termed it coined the term too, like critical mass or critical number. Like, what mm-hmm. did he say a number, or what do you think is the number? Like 500 million, 100 million people, or 200?
He thinks it's 10 million. 10 million with that what is it? Is it 5% or?
But I thought we're already, like, globally, we're already at, like, somewhere between 30 and 60 million people.
Yes, he's meaning, like, 10 million in a single, in the U.S. population.
Oh. Gotcha.
So this would be okay. Specifically 10 million very serious, very, like, mentally aligned Bitcoiners. Uh-huh. Globally, I wonder what that number is globally. But the thing is that as soon as it starts happening, as soon as you get the intransigent minority, anywhere, then it's going to explode in that culture and in that system and in that population.
Right.
And then it's going to feed the growth of the intransigent minority in every other culture and country and population. So it's going to spread like a massive bonfire that's throwing sparks everywhere, and everything is dry leaves. The fiat environment is dry leaves and brush. And, you know, underbrush that's super thick. I mean, there's no better environment to start a massive forest fire. And that forest fire is right. Bitcoin fixing all of our crap.
Yeah. It's just not repairing. It's really transforming the whole structural, you know, toxic soil that we have, because mm-hmm. you cannot build a house on a toxic soil. You know, you have to actually, this is the way it is. You know, when you want to build a house, you have to really analyze the earth, the ground. So this is what we're actually doing. You know, we are really unearthing all these rotten roots, right, with Bitcoin.
Yeah. Getting back to the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. So Guy, before we wrap up there is this idea again, you know, which I'm so excited about. Like today I finished listening to that talk with John Vallis and this filmmaker, R. James something on Twitter, the Hard Money movie.
Yes.
Yeah, it's great.
That was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, and yeah. I think he's pretty open-minded. At least that's what he wrote. He said that would be great to collaborate. I said, wouldn't it be awesome, you know, because that's I pinned that tweet, you know, on my Twitter handle. I said, wouldn't it be great to like really give people a, like much, much bigger picture. You know, not only the causes, you know, the intricacies, the connecting the dots, but like zoom out and like what kind of world, you know, like ask people, all these macro investors, entrepreneurs, Bitcoiners, all the people inside this space, what kind of future do they envision? What is it that, what concretely, specifically do they see in the future? I mean, I have a very specific vision for myself, you know, how is it going to play out, like realistically on a scientific level, technological level, even spiritual level, social level, structural level, you know, people and, you know, all this technology is going to help eventually, you know, people, you know, work less, have more free time, have more leisure time, do more like creative, productive stuff and, you know, evolve into a prosperous civilization.
I think that would be an awesome.
Yeah, and I want your voice awesome to be honest with you. I want your voice as a background, a chocolate voice as a background voice. That would be awesome, huh? Like a real movie, you know?
Dude, I would love to do that. In fact, I actually went to film school. I did film for quite some time back in the day, and film was always my first love until I saw it less as. Saw it more of a short-term, or excuse me, maybe a long-term hobby, and that it wasn't going to pay the bills. And I moved into tech because tech was my second love. But then I found Bitcoin, and like I've kind of gone full circle. And now I feel like I need to get back into film, which I've always had in the back of my mind that I was going to make a movie at some point.
Yeah.
It was just when I could make the investment myself and take my time with it and really do it the way I wanted to do it. The thing that I hated about film and being out in LA was just that I was always doing somebody else's project. And it was never mine, you know? Yeah. But Bitcoin has just completely refocused, and now I've found myself back. I didn't even quite realize that I was doing it, but I'm back in media and, you know, producing a podcast and like all this stuff. So we made a production company, and that is actually one of the goals, is to make a film, potentially a documentary at some point. And even more, something you mentioned earlier is a narrative, a story more than a documentary.
Yeah.
And it's a really hard thing to do because Bitcoin isn't a character, you know, like character drives story, the story of an individual. So you have to really figure out how to tell that story from a story of a personal journey. So it'll be really interesting to see what comes about, but that's absolutely on the table. And I would love to see it happen, whether it's somebody else or me or any, I don't really care who it is. If somebody else is doing it, I want to be involved. You know, hit me up on Twitter at the Crypto Economy. What up? I think you're right. And I think that's also one of those great ways to plant. If you can tell a beautiful story,
touch people in the hearts, you know, that's what I'm saying. If we can, if we can just touch people in the hearts and souls, and of course, you know, they need to comprehend the bigger picture. It's not like, you know, you go out of the, you know, the movie theater and you say, you know, nice movie, you know, life goes on, but it's like something that is like so real, you know, so touching and so, you know, transformational that it changes your perspective, you know?
I think Bitcoin is a huge candidate for that. And I think it's going to change the culture, and I think it's going to change art. You know, very similar to how, you know, Saifedean usually looks at the negative perspective of it, of how art has been obliterated. But you know, you flip the other side of that coin is how art will change and evolve and become meaningful again, like really deep. And I think, as silly as it may sound to some people, I think Bitcoin is actually an incredibly important part of that. And I think you could just see it just in the unbelievable passion of everybody you talk to in this space.
Yeah.
Like we see this as something that changes the way you live and changes the way you think about the world.
Yeah.
And that is not something that just comes along every day.
And creative people and artists, you know, have such a huge, I think, social responsibility and power. Potential to change a perception, you know, and to inspire humanity, and a lot of people are not even aware of their power, you know, what they can do.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I'm saying. Yeah. You know, we could literally like accelerate this by order of magnitude, this process. You know, why are we doing all these podcasts, Ruki? I mean, come on. I mean, you know, why are we, you know, writing so much brilliant articles, books, podcasts, videos, whatever, but it's still like something is missing here, you know?
Yeah. There's definitely more work should be done. Yeah. But I think the key piece is that since we're looking at the kind of an apathy of so many people in the world now, and a loss of faith and a huge explosion in confusion and discourse, or like dissonance, I guess you could say, is to be the ones that are hopeful, to be the community and the people who are looking at the future as something that has unbelievable potential and possibility, not something where the world's just going to freaking explode, everybody's going to set on fire, and everybody's going to be stabbing each other because of their skin color and like all of this stuff. We actually have solutions to these problems. Be the ones talking about the fact that things are going to get better. And people will flock to you. Like I think what we need more than anything is, as maybe silly or shallow as it may sound, is hope. Like people need to feel like the world can get better from this. Yeah. And it can. In fact, we have all of the tools. We're just not using them. We're leaving them on the sidewalk as we run down the street, yelling and screaming about all of our other problems. And we just need to tell them, pick up the tool and let's get to work. Because we can.
Right. So, Gabe, to all my listeners, they should definitely listen to your, you know, chocolate voice and to all the great, you know, content you bring out and the readings you do. It's really amazing. Why don't you tell my listeners first, is it Cryptoeconomic and Bitcoin Audible? Are those two?
Yes. My tag is still The Cryptoeconomy on Twitter, but you can also find me at Bitcoin Audible, which is the new name of the show. But it will be the Cryptoeconomy Network soon, just because I'm trying to create a group of curated content that will cover a lot of different topics around Bitcoin. Right. But you can find me up there. You can just search Guy Swann, just GUISWANN on Twitter, and I'll pop up. Yeah, check out either of those and listen to the show. I've got 421 reads. Today's will be 422. That list is ridiculous. If there is a piece that you thought you were going to listen to or you thought you were going to read at some point and you never got to it, check my feed. It might be there. And that's kind of the beauty of doing reads for most of it. I mean, I obviously have interview episodes like this where I talk to other people that about all kinds of stuff with Bitcoin. And then I also do Guy's Take episodes, which are just me. And I talk about some topic or go into explore some activation thing or technical thing, you know, whatever it is, something that doesn't quite have a piece specifically about it that I can find. But outside of that, some of these pieces are timeless. You know, sometimes I'm reading something from the 1970s. I'm reading like a breakdown of Wei Dai's B Money, Nick Szabo shelling out. That's never going to get old. Robert Classic. Breedlove just had Masters and Slaves of Money. So good. Parker Lewis's entire Gradually Then Suddenly series. If you want a good image of like how crazy this can be and all of the elements going into Bitcoin, I think all the perspectives about Bitcoin, I think it's 13, 14 pieces now in that series. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. I've got the whole thing in audio. Again, if there was something you thought you wanted to read and you weren't sure if you had time, check the feed on Bitcoin Audible. It may very well be there. If it's not, just shoot me a DM. I'll get to it.
Definitely, man. It's so, you know, it's so precious work that you're doing. So hope we can, we can repeat this sometime in the near future. Maybe as a threesome.
Definitely. Oh, no.
We got to really go deeper. And maybe we could sit down with this guy who made the movie and at least, you know, brainstorm a little bit, like what kind of direction we could take without, like, you know, overblowing ourselves, our capacities. But I think it's possible. And if we can achieve that, we can literally bring forth a visible transformation, you know, in the people's perception and action. It's about human action. Use Austrian economists terms. All right.
I do want to say something just because, it's not so much today. I have a hard time keeping up with all of it. But I think Bitcoin content, even if it's just another podcast that some people are doing, I know there's like a bunch of interview podcasts and there's a whole bunch of stuff, but having different perspectives and having access to like different views and stuff is so critical to people coming in so that they can find that one person that they really like or they identify with. And yours has always been one that has been in my feed. That's why I reached out to you randomly. I was like, dude, how have we not done a show together? I need to get you on. We need to talk about this.
We're both out of the box, I think, in some fields.
Yeah. And you've had some great... In fact, what was the other one you mentioned just a little bit ago that I hadn't listened to? I usually write these down immediately. I didn't write it down. Yeah, I'll have to go through your feed. We'll talk about it later. We'll talk about it later.
So
later. But, all right. I just want to say thanks for both the shows. I've been a big listener off and on pretty much for quite some time now. It's always in my feed and I love it. I love what you do too. So thank you.
Thanks so much, bro. Love you.
Yeah, man.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
All right, man. Peace. All right. And that will close us out. I hope you guys enjoyed that.
And don't forget to check out Kiva and Devani on the Total Connector and the Total Bitcoin podcast. And I will have links to both of those, as well as Kivan, which I think is just spelled like his name. I think his Twitter handle. Yeah, it's just the name. Kiyvandavani. That is the handle. So you can find him easily on Twitter and check out all of his awesome Bitcoin stuff. And with that, I hope you're all stacking sats with Swan Bitcoin. If you're not, it's swanbitcoin.com/guy is the way to do it. And of course, don't forget to check out or to enter the fact that we're giving away a BitBlock Boom ticket. We're giving away a free ticket so you guys can join us. You can go to the Bitcoin Audible account on Twitter and like and retweet the giveaway tweet. And so don't miss out on that. If you really wanted to go, but you just weren't able to shell out for a ticket, that is definitely not an opportunity to miss. This is going to be an awesome conference. So check that out. Bitcoin Audible on Twitter. Until next time, guys, take it easy.